Listen on Demand, brought to you by 680 News.
Buffy St. Marie, good to see you again.
Thank you. Same here.
What a wonderful book. I was looking at it and going, it's like a history book. It goes through major periods in time, like Greenwich Village, the Anime Aquash incident, Wounded Knee, all these historic events, and you're there. You're there as this like almost little avatar looking in on, on history. It's a fascinating book. It really is. Not only for your story, but all the history that surrounds the places you've been.
Thank you.
And what did you want this book to do? Was there a special reason for having this book come out at this time?
Well, of course, I should point out, this is not a book by me. This is a book about me. And it was written by Blair Stonechild, who is a PhD, and he's a historian. He's a Cree historian in Saskatchewan. He's from Musketeering Reserve, and he's the head of Native Studies at First Nations University. And I'd been asked many times by rock and roll writers and showbiz writers to do a biography about me and my life. And I didn't think that they would get it right, because they're just not in the right place and have not been at the right time. Blair, as a Cree historian, I knew would get my family stuff right. I knew he'd get the Native stuff right, and then anybody can write about the showbiz stuff that's everywhere. So I should point out that it's written by a real historian, and it kind of does have that feel. Yeah, so it's not like a rock and roll book.
Yeah, and I love that. I just got so into all the stories and all the detail about various periods in history. And I just got back, ironically enough, from Manitoulin Island.
Oh, really?
which I've been going to for 30 years and love dearly. Love,
isn't it
beautiful place.
Yes.
And in reading the book, I found out that has a very special place in your heart as well.
Yeah, I've been to Manitoulin Island many, many times, to Wiquemecong. And I have friends there and have had friends there since the 60s. And in the 60s, I was involved with some friends in various, just trying to make things better, especially in the Toronto area. Wilf Peltier and some others at Wiquemecong. And they invited me to come, and there was a powwow going on, and they had invited people from Saskatchewan who had lost a daughter. And as an adopted person myself, this was interesting to me, because their tradition, it's a Cree tradition in Saskatchewan, if you've lost a child, you always leave your heart open for another child to come in. And they had lost two daughters, and my sister Brenda was first adopted into that family, and I was the second daughter who was adopted into that family. So we're not sure whether I'm actually related to the Paiute family, who were the ones who showed up at Wiquemecong from Saskatchewan for a powwow. But Emil Paiute and I just, we really, really hit it off from the start. He brought me home to his family, and his wife, Clara Starblanket Paiute, became my second mother. And, you know, this has gone on for almost 60 years now, so they were my true second family. Whether we're blood related or not, we've never been able to find out.
Great story, though, and what a wonderful thing to happen to you personally.
It is, and, you know, adoption used to be kind of a matter of shame and misunderstanding. You know, everybody hid it. They hid the facts, and nobody was supposed to know that you were adopted, but I was adopted into a family who were part Native, but they were mostly white, and I was raised in a white town. And it's so interesting. The day before yesterday, I was in Winnipeg, and I was lucky enough to be invited by my guitar player, who's also a filmmaker, to go to Argyle Alternative School, which is a high school in Winnipeg. And they have a multimedia and a film department for the high school kids. And sure enough, they were making a little film about adoption. And they asked me to come over, really, to talk to them about film scoring. But their film just touched me so much, because as an adopted person, I know what that's like. And there are certain pros and cons to it, you know. So it's just beautiful to see how attitudes have changed and how even high school kids are feel confident enough now to deal with such an issue. Isn't that beautiful here in Canada?
Fantastic. Now, also in the book, you talk about a few famous Canadians that you've been involved with, and something that I learned is that you were a big help to Joni Mitchell when she was initially starting out in her career.
Yeah, I was a big Joni Mitchell fan, and nobody wanted to know about her, you know, when she was young and so beautiful and so talented and a great writer. So I carried her cassette around with me in my purse for almost a year, and I would play it for everybody, and nobody wanted to know. I don't know why. Finally, I played it for the guy who was my agent at the time, and he didn't want to know. But another guy in his office, Elliot Roberts, got it right away and went down and saw Joni, and he, of course, he appreciated her right away, and they made a huge, huge career together. A couple years ago, along with my Running for the Drum album, we included A Multimedia Life, which is a biodocumentary that was made here in Toronto by Joan Prowse and Cinefocus. And they interviewed Joni, and, you know, she talked about it too. So she's such a writer, and she's had such a wonderful career. I'm very happy to have been able to do that.
Do you think part of the reason people weren't interested at that time is because she was a woman, and you too were sort of pioneering in the folk singing scene as a woman? It was really kind of a men's world in those days, wasn't it?
It definitely was for a long time. You know, show business, the men are the ones pulling the strings, and women just kind of get led around. I don't know. I think maybe that they just weren't smart enough to hear her. I don't think it did have anything to do with Joni's being a woman. I think I just hadn't played it for the right person, but Elliot Roberts was obviously the right person because he understood her not only as a beautiful chick, as they would have said, but he heard her writing and he heard what she had to say and her beautiful style and her great guitar playing. And another thing that we had shared, when I first got a guitar when I was about 16, because I started off with the piano, I play only by ear. I have no music training, and I am dyslexic in music, I found out a few years ago. But I started out with piano. I switched to guitar when I was about 16, and nobody was there to show me how to play it or how to tune it. So I would tune it differently for every song. I didn't know any better. So Joni also, she heard that, and she fooled around with tunings too. And, some of her songs have a very special quality because of the tuning. So it's another thing we share. And also, she's from Saskatchewan. Yay, Joni.
Now, another historical scene that you were around was the Yorkville scene in the 60s. What was it like then, and how did you come to Yorkville, and what did you do there?
Oh, gosh, I was invited to play at the Purple Onion, and I had been playing coffee houses in New York and L.A. and Florida and Philadelphia and, you know, certain places in the U.S. And I was invited to come and play at the Purple Onion. I remember freezing to death. I had a trench coat and sneakers and a cardboard guitar case. And it was either that or my show clothes, you know. And I remember traveling around on the streetcar and hanging out at Spadina at the Friendship Center there. But Yorkville, like Greenwich Village in New York, it was very interesting. I mean, students were all over the streets. We had discovered our brains. We weren't about to go to some guy's war so that he could make a fortune and we could get dead. It was a very, very active time for youth. It was a real youth movement. It wasn't about drugs. It wasn't about music. It was about young people and whatever we were doing. There were Neil Young was playing, Randy Bachman was playing, not so much in Yorkville, but he was playing rock and roll in Winnipeg. Joni, it was a little bit before Joni hit, but
Gordon Lightfoot there at that time.
I wasn't hanging around with anybody. I was such a loner, but Gordon was becoming well known, and Ian and Sylvia, of course. And I just loved their music. They had the courage to do some really unusual things, singing in parallel fifths and weird kind of tunings that I liked a lot. So it was a very fresh time, and now the internet has kind of taken the place of that scene, in my opinion. You could hear music from all countries. There was nobody standing between you and the country. The music of many countries. It was multicultural. And, of course, in the 70s, everything became very very corporate and very divided up into genres, where you were a country singer or you were a folk singer or you were a blues singer. And I had been everything. And people's ears were open to things the way that people have access to the Internet now. it was really quite a lovely time, and I'm really glad to see a similar effect through the internet of people being in touch and all different kinds of music, culture, events, blogging being available to all of us. That's the way life really is.
And along with it being multicultural, you mentioned courage in different tunings and being original, which you always are. And you were writing songs like Universal Soldier, which also took some courage because being anti-war was really going against the establishment in those days. Did you get any flack for those kinds of songs?
Oh, yeah. You have to remember, in those days, the U.S. was coming out of the Eisenhower years. And, you know, there were a lot of people who didn't even like the idea of John F. Kennedy being president. I mean, now it's very hip and everybody loves him. But in those days, no. He was only 35 years old. No, this must be stopped, you know. The old boys are no longer in control for a minute. We got to get rid of this. So I had written Universal Soldier, and Kennedy didn't have any problem with it. But when Lyndon Johnson came along, he had a big problem with it, and he decided to put me out of business. So for 4 years, I was blacklisted, and my music was not played on the radio. If I were to go on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show, I'd be told that, oh, yeah, you can make celebrity chat and bubble and squeak, but don't talk about Native issues, don't talk about alternatives to war. And then along comes Richard Nixon, and, you know, it was Wounded Knee time in Indian country, and I was writing, you know, songs that actually talked about how reservation lands containing uranium were being stolen by, you know, Mr. Nixon and his pals. And, of course, he was a hero because he was the president. And so I had an additional 4 years of suppression in the U.S., and that kind of put an end to my career. So, you know, we never knew at the time. I didn't find out until the 80s that there were FBI files on me, and I didn't find out until 4 years ago that there were CIA files on me. And I'm a person who had never broken the law. All I had done was tell the truth and sing my songs. And as Taj Mahal put it, he said, they were afraid of a woman with a guitar. So, you know, these things happen. But as an artist, you just keep creating if that's what you love to do. And that's what I loved to do from the time I was a little girl. I was a painter, and I was a musician, and I was a dancer. And I didn't have lessons, but I just made it up myself the way all little children do. Only most little children, I think, get discouraged once they go to school. They get discouraged away from their natural talent, and they're told to put away those baby toys and, you know, now learn what real music is about, you know, start learning to decode European notation. And that never made sense to me, because to me that wasn't music, that was something else. Like many, many musicians, many professional musicians, I'm a by-ear musician. And I found out a few years ago I'm actually dyslexic in music.
How did you find that out?
I found out because I was my son was going to Berklee College of Music, which is another long story, I was there. I was talking to the head of the film scoring department because I had won my Academy Award for Up Where We Belong, and they wanted to come and have me lecture on film scoring because they really didn't know how to do it at the time. And I told the guy, well, you know, I've never been able to learn how to read music. I've tried three times, and not only did I give up, but also the teacher did. And he said, well, you know, you might be dyslexic, and we're doing a study on that. Well, I wanted to be a part of the study. I was so busy I didn't get to be. But then now if you look up music dyslexia online, you'll see that there are at least four books that have been done on music dyslexia. And I can write for an orchestra, but I can't read it back. So it's not as though I'm too silly to learn. No, no, I know how it's done, but my eyes don't work that way. I learn through my ears instead of through my eyes.
Yeah, fascinating.
Curious,
it
huh?
really is, yeah. Take me back a little bit to the Greenwich Village days, another great period in history that's mapped out in the book and beautifully. And I was intrigued to see that rather than dress in the hippie style of the day, you were always a bit glam. Why was that?
Uh-oh.
And you still are.
Some things never change. I know. I always like fashion. You know, One thing about me, I never thought I was going to last 5 minutes. I always thought that every time I step on stage, it's going to be the last time, so I'm going to have some fun. Also, I didn't know that you were supposed to wear sandals and granny dresses. And I used to order clothes in the Frederick's catalog, which is kind of like a raunchy version of the Victoria's Secret catalog. So I had these real hourglass shapey dresses with zigzag hems and things and high heels. And, you know, the Judys and the Jonies weren't doing that. So it made me kind of stand out, and I figured, well, you know, I'm never going to have a career. I'm on the way to India to continue my studies in Oriental philosophy. So, you know, I just pretty much did what I want, and it was a little different for me.
And as you described the Yorkville of that time, was there that feeling in Greenwich Village at that time, too, of people coming together, different kinds of music, and a real scene there?
There was. They were very similar, and it was the same in Europe as well. Very soon after I recorded my first album, I did a sold-out concert in Albert Hall in London, and I was traveling in Paris. Soon I was going to Hong Kong and Tokyo and you know, all over Australia and New Zealand. So for me, you know, the nicest part of my whole career, besides the actual creativity that's continually involved and evolving, the big perk to it has been the travel. I've gotten to see the world. I've gotten to learn from indigenous cultures and from very fancy cultures all over the world. And I've got to teach and kind of be a bridge between the two. And it's really been quite lovely for me. As Blair Stonechild in this biography, which he's calling It's My Way, he named it the same as my first album. That was his choice. This is his book. It's not mine. Mine would be a little bit different. As he points out, I spent a lot of time in Saskatchewan with my family there, and I would alternate it with big fancy concerts in Paris, and then I'd be on the reserve, you know, the Mohawk Reserve at Akwesasne, or, you know, I'd be in indigenous lands in Scandinavia, hanging with Sami people there in Lapland, or in Australia I'd be with Aboriginal people there, and that's kind of the way my life has been, and it's so lovely for me. I mean, I've had the kind of life that if I were only a careerist, I wouldn't have gotten to have. And if I had had huge, huge, tremendous success like Madonna or Michael Jackson, you know, I'd have to live in some hotel, you know, penthouse and be afraid to go out on the streets. But it's really nice to be able to have anonymity in some places and, you know, the perks and fun of fame in other places. So I think I got the best of both worlds.
I think you do, too. Tell me a bit about your first Mac computer, and you got into computers really ahead of the curve, and you're still, with your artwork, doing amazing things. And do you still have that first Mac computer? Is that true?
Thank you. Yes, I do. I still have it. I've always kept it, you know. The way that the merchants in our world work, you know, you must throw away everything good from yesterday so that we can have your dollars today. So they pretend that things from, you know, last year's fashion are no longer any good. Well, I never went for that. So I tend to keep things that I love, you know, whether it's my, you know, certain things from high school clothes, because I've always been the same size, or my computers. I've kept all my great Macintosh computers. I was very fortunate in the 60s to get involved with electronic music, and I made the first ever totally electronic quadraphonic album. It was called Illuminations. And art students loved it, and electronic music students loved it, but the folkies just didn't get it. You know, they just, what is that? Computers, well, no, that's, they thought computers was for doing your taxes and making pie charts, right? They just didn't know, because they had no experience with electronic music, let alone the computers that would come along in a few years later. But I got into, there was no place I could go after doing Illuminations except to movie scoring, which I did. That's where I took those skills, was into movie scoring. And of course, they didn't throw away my guitar. And computers don't replace guitars or pianos or the human voice. Just like watercolors don't replace oils or sculpture, they're just a different tool to do the things that we love to do, whether it's writing or music or, in my case, painting as well. And a Sinclair and a Fairlight were a part of my life in the 70s and 80s. And then in 1984, when the first Macintosh came along, oh, I was happy. I was living in Hawaii, and I've been in Hawaii for a long time. And I could make my paintings. I could make my music. I could make my writings. I could put them on little floppy disks, put it in my purse, come to Toronto, go down to Elm Street Computers, and continue my work wherever I was in the world. So it just made sense for me. And because I entered the world of computers through the arts instead of through, you know, school or business or accounting or making war, you know, I was involved with a Macintosh as opposed to an IBM computer. And IBMs and Windows were developed to keep secrets, you know, accounting, taxes, and making war. It was all done with the architecture of an IBM computer was, it was meant not to be user-friendly because they were trying to keep secrets. So the architecture from the very beginning was different from Macintosh, which they said was for the rest of us. And I got one of the very first Macintoshes. I got it in 1984, just before the big ad at the Super Bowl. And it's been just such an incredible tool to record all my different kinds of art, whether it's visual or writing or music.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And it still works.
Oh, well, that original one, I don't know. You know, it was 128K. Can you believe it? And I was thrilled, but I was using Mac Paint. And in the art exhibits that I'm doing, some of the paintings are like the history of digital art. I started them in 1984 with Mac Paint, and as new programs came out, I would overdub on the same painting. You know, I would use Super Paint or Pixel Paint or, Photoshop when Photoshop came out. I remember the day that we had the first color monitors. I mean, I was the first one in line. I just had to have it. So it's really been good for me as an artist to have Macintosh.
Fantastic. Buffy, how have you avoided the pitfalls of drugs and alcohol, being in a business that's known for both of them?
I don't know. You know, I never developed a taste for alcohol at all. I mean, everybody says they don't drink, right?
Oh, except for a six-pack on the weekend, you know, and wine at dinner, and you know.
But I don't drink at all just because I don't care for it. So it wasn't a deliberate choice on my part. And I made some terrible social gaffes in Europe, you know, because I was very famous, for instance, in Paris, and, you know, they'd have a reception for me at some wonderful, beautiful place and have these wonderful bottles of wine, and I'd say, oh, no, thanks, I don't care for it, I don't drink. Oh, my gosh, that was the wrong thing to say. So I just, I don't know, I made things up so as not to offend people. I'd say it gives me a headache or something. Some people would assume that I was an alcoholic and trying to stay on the wagon, but no, I just never developed a taste for it. And with drugs, unfortunately, I was addicted by a doctor in the 60s, deliberately. He later, I'm told, was sent to prison for, pretty young girl comes along, he addicts her, and they turn her out. And I was a girl on my own, so I guess I was a likely candidate. So I was addicted by accident. But that's not the same as hanging out with your friends and getting high and falling into that kind of drug rut. I got rid of it immediately, and I just never developed a taste for opiates and things. I can't say the same of pot. I did inhale, but it's that's a natural thing that's different. That's like grape juice as opposed to whiskey, you know. So, but it's been very, very good for my health to have avoided, especially alcohol, because when I see people my same age, they just don't feel as well as I do, and I think they don't have as much fun, so I'm happy.
And are you rooting for Obama to get in for a second term?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have my little complaints as to what could have been done better, but no, I certainly am. I campaigned for him the first time. I am definitely a supporter. I think he's certainly the better of two choices, you know. And politics in the world is so crazy anyway. It takes up so much of our time, and so often it seems to be just a choice between a crook and a thief when it comes to political parties. But when you have someone who at least you know was a professor of constitutional law and knows what he's talking about, oh, what an uphill battle, though, to get by the opposition. You know, it's kind of like football.
Yeah, I'm not happy with politics in the world these days.
Yeah, well, we're rooting for him here. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, I think Mitt Romney, I don't know. That's a little scary.
Oh, no, the
Republicans are just so scary, I find.
Yeah, I think it's tragic. I just think it's tragic what's going on with right-wing politics. I mean,
just lie. They'll just say anything. There's just no basis for anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest challenge these days facing Native people? I mean, they've come a long way, but what is the biggest challenge now and today?
Poverty.
Still.
Poverty. There are some front row winners. There's some of us who luck out and we can help other people, and there's a lot that we can do and a lot that we have done. We do have our lawyers like Delia Opikaku, who's a Cree lawyer practicing here in Toronto, Albert Angus, who's a Cree lawyer practicing in Saskatchewan. You know, they were very early to hone their skills and make things better. You know, they work not only on local issues but also on truth and reconciliation. So we have a lot of very, very strong people and well-educated people. But the networking that goes along with succeeding in education or politics or just getting ahead is not really open to the poor. So it's hard when you're poor, even if you're very smart, to be effective in making change on the local level or the national level. And poverty is the problem. Some reserves are doing pretty well, you know, because, I don't know, they have an influx of money with casinos or something, which they have never had before. But most Native people are still very poor. And the greed that's going on in the resource industries, you know, the tar sands and the, you know, stealing of land and hoodwinking people, it's... it's. I think it's just an immaturity in the human race right now. You know, a lot of people are mature, and some people are not, and they're insecure. They live for money, and they want every last dime, whether it's in another country or our own. Poverty is an issue, and it's something that. We're trying to fix it all the time, and we need all the help we can get. We have made strides. We'll continue to make strides, and thank you to everybody who understands that. I mean, poverty is not just a racial thing, but you asked about the biggest problem in Indian country, and it's still poverty. But it's becoming increasingly a problem for everybody. It's becoming increasingly a problem for everybody. When it comes to Native people, though, it's always been like this. If... the majority of people are doing okay. They don't have time to consider the minorities. They're having fun, and they forget about the poor people. And if the majority, too, are going down, then they're having a hard time, too, so they tend not to share. So that's kind of it's a problem. Yeah.
And are you still involved with children and your programs teaching children?
The Cradle Board Teaching Project, I think you're talking about. The Cradle Board Teaching Project is the main initiative of my Nahiwan Foundation, which originated as a scholarship foundation. I started the Nahiwan Foundation in the 60s to put Native people through college. And my proudest day was when I found out that two of our scholarship recipients had gone on to become the presidents and founders of tribal colleges. That was wonderful. So now we have piloted the Cradle Board Teaching Project for 12 years, and we've moved on to university. So I'm working with universities, and we're working at the university level, teaching them how to do the project and how to write interactive multimedia curriculum in core science, geography, government. So working with college professors at UBC and the University of Saskatchewan and Saskatoon, it takes up a lot of time, but I think it's going to, I really think it's going to change things at the local level and at the national level by teaching teachers how to do it even better through the use of multimedia interactive curriculum.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Buffy St. Marie, always, always a pleasure to speak with you. I love the book. I love you.
Thank you, and thank you to Blessed Don't Child for having written the book.